really long time and has been interested in it almost his whole life. He had a long and outstanding career as one of the top writers for the Wine Spectator, and he left and started his own consulting business. And he's here to talk and enlighten us all a little bit about the this question of the 100-point scale, which most people either love or they really hate. But I don't see too many people who kind of have a mushy opinion about it. So, Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you get started.
Thank you very much, Jordan. It's really a pleasure for me to be here. One of the things that I enjoyed most when I was a critic was tasting wines from regions as they were developing and seeing the improvement. And certainly for the 10 years I was a critic, that was very applicable to the Anderson Valley. But I got up here a couple of days before the event, and I was visiting a winery, and we were talking about the technical conference, and one of the staffers asked me, as I was telling them about my talk, well, do you believe in the 100-point system? And it's I felt like I was being asked about Bigfoot. And I mean, part of the problem, I think, is that the system is too often discussed in dogmatic terms, right, wrong, true, false. And I think a more productive approach for both consumers and producers is to recognize its strengths, its limitations, and apply that knowledge to make informed decisions. Now, I've thought about the scoring system for a long, long time, and I frankly always had some ambivalence about it. I've never been on the receiving end of a disappointing review, so I'm sure that creates something beyond ambivalence. But the 100-point system, whatever you might say about it, is indisputably the industry standard. It's got to have pretty close to 100% market share. It's Microsoft if there were no Apple, okay? Everyone uses it. And you don't get this kind of overwhelming popularity and market penetration unless it offers some powerful advantages. And I really want to start by looking at some of those advantages. Now, the first thing, and it's very important, is that everyone understands it. We all get that grading system. It's a part of our culture. So consumers can make very quick, easy buying decisions. You see a wine's $15. You see it's 90 points. Done. And another aspect of it that I think has really worked in its favor is it's so concise. And that is crucial in any successful marketing. That score on a shelf talker, around the neck of a bottle, flashed on a homepage of a winery website, or on a retailer's website, that grabs the attention of potential consumers. And it has that same effect when it's in a wine publication, when you see it in someone's buying guide or in a report about a region's wines. And it would be next to impossible to have that kind of quick impact without the numeric score. I mean, you can try to communicate something descriptively about a wine, but it's more challenging, and it's not going to catch the eye the same way. I also think that, all brilliant marketing is going to play to some aspect of our psychology as buyers. Luxury products, they're marketed to convince us that our selection of that luxury product says something about us as people, or it makes us feel as if we're fulfilling some image of ourselves. And there's no mistaking that. The 100-point system as applied to wine is brilliant wine marketing. And, I mean, I think it really took hold in the States with Robert Parker. I mean, particularly with the 1982 Bordeaux. He started the Wine Advocate in 78, I think it was. But it was with the quality of the 82 Bordeaux that it really became entrenched in the wine consumer's mind. And it has made wine so accessible to so many consumers. And if you think about, well, how does the 100-point system play to our psychology? And what I'd say is it touches our desire for control, or put differently, not to look stupid. Now, wine is arguably the most complex and potentially intimidating consumer product there is. If you just kind of tick through all the variables, you've got regions, vineyards, grape varieties, vintage distinctions, not to mention producers, and then the temporal factor of how wines change in bottle. It's a lot of variables, and for the uninformed consumer, it can make them dizzy. So I think that all of these complexities can be more of an issue in the U.S. because we are not fundamentally a wine-drinking culture. It's not a part of our national DNA. I mean, the way it is in a place like France, I'd say, or Italy, or Spain. And while there's been a tremendous upsurge in interest in wine over the last 10 or so years, the wine market has gotten much, much more complex because there are just so many new brands and there are so many new regions. I mean, it was something that I noticed all the time when I was a critic. All these new brands that you'd never seen before that were just coming through to be reviewed. And if anything, I'd say the pace of that has continued since I got out of wine criticism. I'd also like to interject, if you could just wait on tasting the glasses, because I'm trying to time it here to prove a couple of points. But now, even very informed wine drinkers would have known next to nothing about the Anderson Valley 10 years ago. Now, given all the challenges to be informed, to know what's out there, to make a good decision, knowing that score is empowering for the consumer. So you don't need to walk into a retail shop feeling at a loss, asking for guidance from someone you don't know and possibly don't trust. You look at the score, you look at the price, and you can make your own informed decision. And I mean, I guess that brings us to one of the biggest benefits of the 100-point system, is that it sells wine. Those scores sell wine, and it gets people very excited about wine, which, I mean, as everyone knows, it's not so easy to sell wine right now. So it's anything you can do to facilitate that is going to be a benefit. Now, I remember when I was reading the initial Parker reviews of the 82 and 86 Bordeaux, and I mean, I was really jazzed by these wines, and I wanted to get them, and I was comparing the notes and just trying to make an informed decision. And maybe like they were around 92 or 93 points. And this was a time when 92 or 93 points actually meant something. So it made a big difference in the decisions that a lot of people make. Now, how many consumers are there here? As opposed to wine professionals, excuse me. Okay. Of the consumers here, how many of you sometimes base buying decisions on wine reviews? Pretty good number.
Yeah.
How many people are in the trade here? How many of you sometimes base buying decisions on wine reviews? Smaller proportion, though maybe people are hesitant to admit it, right? So, but I mean, clearly that everyone is at least very aware of what kind of reviews they're getting and following them. Now, another big advantage of the 100-point system is that it helps organize tastings for critics. If you're tasting through a lot of wines and you're not scoring them, it can be very challenging if you look back at your notes to understand exactly what you preferred or how you rank them. And using a numeric system eliminates much of that uncertainty. And when I first started taking or writing wine notes back in the 80s, I wasn't using scores. The idea of it bothered me. And then looking back over my notes, I sometimes, could tell that I liked a wine. I mean, or you could tell that you really didn't like one, but you couldn't make fine distinctions about, which one did I like better? Which one should I buy? And a lot of that is eliminated with a numeric system.
Hey, Dan, because I think that we're going to want to have a lot of discussion with everyone, before you get to the drawbacks, maybe start the tasting, and then we'll talk about the drawbacks as people start to taste, too.
Oh, okay.
Let's Unless see. You have a few other key things you want to hit right now.
Well, let me see. Let me go over a couple things, and then just in a minute or two, we'll start with the tastings. But wanted to also ask, how many of you participate in blind tastings in which you're writing notes and scoring the wines? Okay, and I think after you go through this, you understand that while it's very tempting to throw stones at critics, I mean, especially the prominent ones, it's not easy. And it's easy enough to score and review a wine, but to really capture the character of the wine with that review and score isn't so simple. And one thing I'd suggest is that everyone organize a blind tasting with either with friends. If you're in the trade, it's easy to do. Get 8 to 10 wines, brown bag them, taste through them, write a note, score them. Take a break and have someone rearrange the bottles. Go back, taste through the whole thing again, and then compare your results. I mean, you're not examining the wine so much as you are how you're doing as a blind taster. And I guarantee you that there will be some significant variation, not only in the descriptions of the wines, but probably in the scores, depending upon how they were arranged. Now, let's start by tasting the first two glasses, going, I think, from your left to right. Now, I chose fruit juices. One's an orange juice, one's a grapefruit juice. And I chose them because I thought it would illustrate a point perhaps a bit more easily than it might with comparable wines. And I think about the weaknesses, the limitations that plague the 100-point system, Most of them apply to any numeric grading system for wine. I mean, I think some critics who are scoring wines use a score range, which strikes me as a wise idea because it implies a humility about the precision of the reviews. And, I mean, I think Michael Broadbent has always used the, 1 to 5 stars. And I think Alder Yarrow does a score range, like 9 to 9.5 or something. You can use a 10-point score, you can use a 100-point score, but it's pretty much the same thing. And also, as I talk about some of the limitations of the 100-point system, and of course that might seem more interesting and entertaining than the strengths of it, I'm talking at the same time about as much about the process by which professional critics review wines, how they evaluate them, how they taste multiple wines in a flight. And so I've found that with pretty much all the critics I know of, the wines will be grouped by region, vintage, and varietal blend. And some people might taste a minimum of like 5 or so wines, but I would say 10 to 30 at a sitting is more typical. And so try to keep that process in mind and the realities of that process as we go through some of the challenges of the system. But has everyone tasted the juices? Okay. Start on my right. Who preferred the first juice? Who preferred the second juice? I'm sorry. Second juice again on the left side of the room. It seems fairly even.
Fairly even. A lot of people didn't vote.
Okay. Come on, people. Try the juices and vote. One more try. Who preferred the grapefruit juice? Okay. And who preferred the orange juice? Okay, a bit more grapefruit juice.
Yeah.
Now, other side of the room. Who preferred the first one, which was the orange juice? Who preferred the grapefruit juice? There's more people on this side of the room preferred the grapefruit juice. More people preferred the orange juice.
And how many people would score the orange juice between 90 and 100?
Yeah.
I'm just curious.
See, one of the reasons I selected these was because I felt that intrinsically the grapefruit juice was a better grapefruit juice, a higher scoring grapefruit juice, and that was an orange juice. Grapefruit juice is a fresh product. The orange juice is made from concentrate, and it just didn't seem to me to have as much fresh fruit character. But what you see is that more people who tried the grapefruit juice first preferred it. More people who tried the orange juice first preferred it. And what happens is after tasting the orange juice, which has more sugar and less acidity, the grapefruit juice tastes kind of severe, almost bitter in the finish. I'm sure many of you noticed that. That, in a microcosm, is a lot of the challenge of professional tastings, of tasting flights of wine. Now, I'm sure some people will say, wait a minute, it's orange juice to grapefruit juice or apples to oranges. But there are marked stylistic differences between wines that are from the same vintage, the same region, and the same varietal. And if you happen to be a producer who favors a grapefruit style of wine, that is crisper acidity, less sugar, you are going to be at a potential disadvantage next to producers who make richer, fleshier wines that have more alcohol and potentially more residual sugar.
Maybe from concentrate.
Maybe from concentrate. So I think that while it's pretty indisputable that the 100-point system is an enormously effective sales and marketing tool for both the industry and critics, what's not so clear is whether these reviews can consistently communicate to the consumer the important information about a wine, or that these scores communicate what the consumer thinks they mean. Let me try to expand on that. Consumers are going to interpret a score as indicating what's a better wine for them to buy. But generally speaking, that is not the case. It's going to tell you what showed better in a comparative tasting. And they're two very different things.
But I think that's a good point. I mean, I have this question. You mentioned about how it's easier for the critic to organize his notes and to see which wines you really liked and which you didn't when you put a score. But, you know, I think since you're getting into the drawbacks, this question of, well, is anything wrong with that, actually having to go through and read what you wrote about it and what you thought versus just a numeric judgment? I mean, wouldn't a lot of people who are detractors say, what you wrote without a score is more true to the wine than just your judgment of preference, which is what the score ultimately is.
I see what you're saying, but I think as a practical reality, when you're tasting 10 or 15 or 20 wines, and generally the reason you're doing this is to make recommendations to your readers. Give them buying recommendations. And it's just not as defined and clear as I think consumers want it to be merely by describing it verbally. That score, again, it's concise and the message is clear. And I think you're right that the score can become a crutch for the critic. And I've been in that position, that if you're tasting a lot of wines and you're finding it a little difficulty finding what's individual about them and describing them accurately, well, the score communicates what you like. And I've had many producers who've related to me the frustration of reading a review of their wines, seeing a review that was descriptively more or less identical to another wine, but that other wine happened to get 5 or 6 more points. So clearly, there's something about the wine that is not really, it's not captured in the number or in the description.
You know, what about this situation? One night I was sitting in a restaurant in New York, and next to me at a table was a famous critic who worked for Robert Parker at the time, and I could hear everything going on at the table. And he had a 1982 Margaux, you know, and he swirled it, and he said, you know, wow, well, it's 95 points in the nose. And then he tasted it, and he said, oh, but sadly, only 88 points in the palate. What does that mean? And then, also, compared to a score that might have originally gotten. I mean, you see all these things.
Well, I think that brings up a really good point about precision. Now, precision in the kind of geek speak sense of it, and I think this is straight off of Wikipedia, refers to repeatability. If you perform the same test multiple times, that is, reviewing the same wine, will you get the same results? It's one of the two basic criteria by which you evaluate the validity of any measurement system. And I've really found that with good tasters, the scores can be fairly consistent if the wines are tasted repeatedly right around the same time. But as time goes on, all bets are off. And I think that is part of the problem, is that very often reviews, they're going to give three or four pieces of information. They're going to give you a score. They're going to give you a description. They're going to give you a time frame during which you should drink the wine, or when the wine will be at its peak performance. And very often, the scores of the wines, when they're retasted, very heralded vintages get re-reviewed 10 years down the line, and there can be dramatic differences in how they perform.
I always find that to be kind of sketchy for me. I mean, it's another question, and I see as a potential drawback when a critic is reviewing wines that are right out. Is he or she reviewing the current vintage of Bordeaux and saying this is how the wine is right now? It's a 90 point, or are they taking into account what should happen to it, how it should go, or is it? It can't be 90 for the rest of its life if they go back 10 years and say, oh, you know, I just had this wine again and I give it a 97 now. Well,
I think that most critics say that what the score refers to is the wine at its best. And if they think the wine needs some cellaring time, that's usually indicated in the note.
But if, as you said, that there can often be huge discrepancies from a wine originally tasted and then retasted later on.
Right.
To me, that's a huge problem in precision and consistency, exactly like you just described. And I'm also interested, considering that, like a basketball coach, if his player is not hitting free throws in crunch time, he'll take him out and he won't play. In your experience at Wine Spectator, or what you know of other publications that score, are the critics tested? Are they for consistency every now and then? Do they pull a fast one on them?
Yes. The people who organize the tastings often insert wines that have been previously tasted so that the critics can test themselves and to verify that they're doing their jobs by being consistent. But, I mean, I think this also raises another point in that there are some winemakers who are just very good at making wines that show very well upon release. There are some specific tricks of the trade that winemakers can apply to make things very showy, very flashy. For example, I know of some winemakers, principally Cabernet producers, who like to put the wines into a new batch of new barrels maybe 3 or 4 or 5 months before they expect to do bottling. They went into new barrels after fermentation, and then maybe 15 or 18 months down the line, they go back into some new barrels because they absorb this flash of new oak character. And there are a lot of critics who love that. And so that makes the wine show well. At the same time, some vintners will blend in a portion of a more recent vintage because it gives the wines an added freshness. And, I mean, by law, if you have a vintage on a label, that means it's 95% of that vintage. And but these tools, and good winemakers have a lot of other ones that I'm sure I never learned about, make a big difference in how wines show.
If any winemakers here want to share some of those tricks with the group, I'd be really curious to know about them. We're going to take a question here, and then
Sure. Well,
let's get on to taste the wines.
I think that's a very valid point. And I think it's, I mean, it's maybe a little clearer for something with Sauvignon Blanc, but I think it's equally applicable to practically any kind of wine. I mean, if you're reading consumer reports, they're not going to be giving you their ratings and their evaluations for a pickup truck next to their race cars or a luxury vehicle. It's just apples and oranges, and the people who are looking at one aren't as interested in the other. So I think that that is a big part of the limitation of the system, is that it puts these wine styles that are so different, and there's so much subjectivity involved about recognizing the difference between these different styles, and it tries to evaluate them on the same measuring stick. Let's please start to taste through the wines. Now, as you are doing this and tasting through the wines, I wanted to play a little game with you, which is called Match the Wine Note with the Wine. So I've got a couple of wine notes, and I'm not going to give them to you verbatim, but I'm going to read you some of the descriptors and see if you can associate them with the appropriate wine. One note, one wine, it's described as medium-bodied, elegant, perfumed, round. And some of the descriptors are smoky, underbrush, blueberry, raspberry, earth, black cherry.
Sounds another, incredible.
I'm sorry?
Sounds incredible.
Okay. Well, it got a very good score, but not an incredible score. The other note is full-bodied, fleshy, intense, concentrated, complex, and descriptors are black cherry, wild berry, raspberry, and delicate finish.
Same critic?
No. So, who would guess that the first note, the medium-bodied, elegant, perfumed, round, who would guess that it goes with wine number three? All right, I'm sorry. First wine. So, three, or the first wine. Who would guess that that note goes with the second wine? Okay, more guesses, I'd say, for the second wine.
Yeah, slightly. Again, a lot of abstainers.
Right. Okay, so, well, this is where kind of messing with you because both notes are for the same wine. And while there are some similarities in the descriptors, black cherry is noted in both, raspberry, the characterization of the style of the wine are completely different. Medium-bodied, elegant, perfumed, round, full-bodied, fleshy, intense, concentrated. So it demonstrates, I think, some of the difficulties, and perhaps can be a cautionary tale about what you take from a review and how you think it's going to apply to your tasting experience. Now, I don't know if either of these notes seems an accurate description of the first wine to you. Work for you? Yeah? Only if you have a watchful editor, which no writer likes. So.
And this is about the 100-point scale, not the 100-word scale.
Uh-huh. Well, I think, I mean, what you usually find is that the higher-scoring wines get more verbiage. And it seems to be a pretty consistent fact of how wines are reviewed. Now, the... So both those notes were for the first wine, and the scores were pretty similar. The second wine was described as medium-bodied, delicate, and this is my favorite one, nice.
Kiss of death. I said the kiss of death.
Yeah, that it did not get 99 points. The descriptors included jasmine, wilted rose, plum, and black cherry. Now, who feels that these two wines are fairly comparable in quality? Who feels that... Do all the rest of you feel it's a dramatic difference? Please raise your hand. Okay, who prefers the first wine? Who prefers the second wine? Fairly even, I think.
Yeah.
Now, thinking back to the tasting of the juices. If you taste the wines again, but in a different order, are you going to have a different impression or a different preference? Go ahead. And want to, as you taste through the wines and look at them again, you begin to think about what kinds of wines are going to do best in professional tastings when you're tasting multiple bottles. And part of the answer to that has to do with palate fatigue. That is, if you're in the process of tasting 10 or 20 or however many wines, some critics are known to taste 50-plus wines. It doesn't matter how talented or experienced you are, it becomes difficult to detect nuance. And I tried to do some research about palate fatigue and really didn't get too far. I contacted the sensory specialist at UC Davis, Hildegard Heyman, and there really isn't a whole lot of information out there. But some of what I saw suggested that it's as much about our brains as it is about our senses, and that's all humans are hardwired to notice change. I'm sure that's evolutionary. It's because change represents a potential threat. And visually, we notice movement. And our awareness of smells diminishes over time. You walk into that kitchen and there's a powerful aroma of sautéed garlic. After time, you become less sensitive to it. So under those circumstances, what is going to stand out? And the answer is, in wine tastings, huge. Bigger, richer wines that have more alcohol and more oak and even possibly some residual sugar. And the presence of residual sugar in wines mitigates an impression of astringency, and it can soften the impression of tannins. And if you're tasting multiple red wines and multiple white wines, particularly higher acid white wines, there is a cumulative effect of how these build up on your palate. And then when you taste a wine with some sugar to it, or just more richness, it shows better, and it doesn't seem as severe. So what often happens in blind tastings and professional tastings is that it's not that the best wines get the highest scores. It's that the best examples of a particular style of wine, i.e. huge, get the highest scores. And I think that critics, for the most part, do an outstanding job of recognizing the best examples of that particular style. What's more challenging and what's just the constant difficulty in professional tastings is identifying subtler wines and identifying wines that just speak more softly.
Well, but that's if they're putting in if they're doing a great job of identifying those styles. The problem is that those subtle wines are put in with the same wines, and they're, you know, like the gentleman was saying about tasting Sauvignon Blancs from different regions. At least generally, Sancerres are probably tasted against each other versus New Zealand. But when you're talking about a lineup of Cabernets, you're going to have subtler ones. Versus, you know, the magazines are not separating those by style.
Exactly.
Right.
And it's very difficult to do that because you can be familiar with the producer, but they're variables from vintage to vintage and from vineyard to vineyard. And sometimes people make a wine that's atypical for them. So there's just really no way of gauging that. But it's not only a question of palate fatigue, as you see in these tastings, trying one wine next to another and one juice to another. It's what the wine review tells you in a professional tasting. It's not identifying the wine in terms of some idea of quality. It's defining the wine to a great extent in reference to the wines you've tasted earlier that day. And again, that doesn't have much relevance to the experience of how you're going to consume a wine and how most consumers are going to approach a wine.
Did you want to tell us the scores from those wines?
No.
No.
Wanted to preserve the anonymity.
Okay. Well, we're going to – I'm sure you have some more to say, but we want to get some discussion going too. So, sir. Okay. Recount. He made 2 points. One, if anyone couldn't hear him, he said, "We don't ever get to see how a score like a 93-point score is built. So, you know, in other forms of judging, you get a certain. It's broken down and then added up. And his first point was, do you think that something like that would be reasonable for a wine score?
You know what? I think it sounds better in concept than it would work in execution, because I think if you read Robert Parker's The Wine Advocate on the front of it, he does break it down that way. He says that a certain number of points go for the appearance, a certain number of points go for the aromas and the flavors. But I think what actually happens as critics taste wine is it's more of an intuitive process. It's you taste a wine and you're giving it a score, but you're not breaking it down systematically that way.
And then your second point was what it was about Malbec versus Chianti.
I think that no, that's a very good point. And no, I don't. Well, the point that if you've got two wines that are from completely different regions and perhaps very different prices and they're getting scores, can you really equate them? And I think it does bring up the question of, well, what people should use as their basic reference points. And maybe it makes sense to start with price because that's how a lot of people start with their buying decisions. So, I mean, it's really a matter of identifying what you value.
We have a question from back there.
I don't think it's terribly useful.
Sir.
I think as time goes on, it's inevitable that there will be more voices. And I think that's a very positive thing. And I think as the wine consumer learns more, they're going to be less blindly accepting of so-called voices of authority. But I think there will always be a place for the Robert Parkers and Wine Spectators of the world. That's a good focus. I think that as people branch out into wines that are just less familiar to them, it is much tougher to have a consistent take on them.
And why, if you are deciding to subscribe to a certain critic, why you might want to pick ones with real focuses and specialties, like you said. A question there.
Sounds like sound advice.
what do you think about that?
I'm not familiar with the work, but it's not a surprise at all because I mean you've often seen that. I mean many wineries will cite a gold medal from this event or a gold medal from that event, and there are a lot of events. So. But I think as someone else had asked, when you're tasting that many wines, first of all, there are very, very few people, even professional critics, who I think can make informed, consistent judgments when they're tasting 50 or 75 or 100 wines in a day. It's not easy.
Or when they're tasting right in front of the winemaker.
Absolutely. Absolutely has the same effect, and that's kind of bringing me to some of the weaknesses of the system that I was talking about, that I wanted to get at, that the downside to the impact of these scores is that if you don't get the scores, it can be very difficult. It's much more difficult to move your wines if you're not getting good reviews.
Or try resubmitting them after 10 years because you might get a completely different review. We've only got a few minutes left, but I want to take a few more questions or comments. Ma'am, in the back? Yeah.
I don't think it's used between the grape growers and the winemakers so much. Very often, wineries have certain ripeness conditions that influence contracts, but I don't think the scale is used in that way.
I can add that I know, for instance, within the industry, at least with wine buyers, with sommeliers, for instance. I know some that if a salesperson will come in and even give some critic score while they're tasting the wine buyer on the wine, the wine buyer will say, don't tell me that, or get the hell out. You know, I don't. Can you please tell us what your industry is? Coffee taster. You guys, well, but you don't have a professional range of critics scoring the coffees, do you? Oh, you do? Okay, we don't, okay. But in general, within the industry, those scores are not huge currency, I think. Let's take a couple more.
Oh. Do I have a moment to make a couple other points?
Or
do
very you quickly.
Okay. Well, a couple of things that I think are very important is that in reference to certain styles showing best in professional tastings, a lot of producers want the scores, and they need the scores. So they're making wines of a particular style. And I think really one of the biggest threats to the wine market, to the consumer and the industry, is the sameness of styles, because people are going for ripe and rich. And part of the fascination and beauty of wine is its complexity and its variety. And I think we are missing some of that in the current market. And I also find that many of the highest scoring wines are wines that I don't necessarily like to drink that much. They don't play well with others. It doesn't go as well with food. They hog the table and say, look at me, aren't I huge? Which is not a good dinner companion to my mind. And the other aspect is that very often the wines that get the highest scores have a certain chemical profile in terms of low acidity, high pH, residual sugar. And those conditions very often lead to wines that age badly. So you're buying these uber wines of tremendous richness and ripeness with an expectation that you can cellar them, and very often the wines that get these huge reviews are least likely to reward cellaring. So it's an issue.
Yeah. Okay, we only have time for one or two more.
I'm sorry?
Questions about Cellar Tracker,
which is a website. Do you know what? I think people always will want to know who the reviews are coming from. So I think I'm not sure if that's going to work as well for wine as it might for some other products.
Okay. And Steve.
Thank you.
I think that there's an advantage to the individual taster because you know where it's coming from. And if you're familiar with the critic, you've got some sense of their preferences. And I kind of feel that with panels, it's like that old expression about a horse designed by a committee. It moves towards the middle, but it doesn't necessarily allow you to highlight what an individual sees as noteworthy or distinctive.
Yeah. Sir, in the back.
Well, that was a point that I wanted to make, and yeah, that the 100-point scale ain't what it seems, because any bottled wine that does not taste like pond scum is going to get 75 points. And as a practical matter, it's more likely to be getting somewhere between 85 and 100 points. It's a 15 or maybe 20-point scale. And that there has been, for, I'd say, reasons related to the industry itself and for the needs of critics, there's been marked grade inflation over the years because critics are looking for wines to recommend. It's not that they're consciously deciding to overscore wines, but they're just looking for wines to recommend. And as time has gone on, I think it's been a bit of a frog in the water scenario.
Yeah, I call that score creep.
Yeah.
And that's not how I talk about Robert Parker.
Okay.
But no, I will say that I did a survey a couple of years ago and found that actually he, of all the people scoring wines in his magazine, was the lowest scorer. And so the tendency, even among his minions, to inflate their scores to draw more attention to themselves or to these wines was greater than Parker's own. So I thought that was interesting. One final comment and then from you, Dan, and then we're done.
Well, I hope that people will just kind of keep in mind that their judgments are what counts most, because I think there's an impulse on the part of a lot of consumers to say, well, you know what, this critic knows more. He's got so much more experience or knowledge, and they do have more experience and knowledge, but how they taste wines isn't necessarily going to mean anything to how we drink wines, and they're never going to know what we like more than we do.
I think that you started off making a case for the scores, but by the end, it sounds like you have a much greater ambivalence about it.
That's fair.
Are you happy to not be doing it anymore, or do you miss it?
I am happy doing what I'm doing, and I'm pursuing other interests. But as time has gone on, I've felt that using an objective scale, like a measuring stick, to try to capture the reality of something as subjective and contextual as wine is kind of pointless. It misses the truth of why we enjoy wines and how we enjoy it. And I think the most important thing the American consumer can really grab is that it is subjective and that they don't need this sort of objective validation of what's good.
Thank you so much. And I want to find out about the Robert Parker of coffee scoring myself. And Dan Sog, he'll be around this evening if you want to continue this discussion. And don't get up, because we're going right in to the very last panel of the day. Just a couple of minutes.